Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is Blueprint for a Creative Culture with Kate Rutter from Adaptive Path, who is someone that I really admire and enjoy her work quite a bit. I do want to welcome anybody who's new to the club. And if you've seen the magazine, grab a magazine on the way out. Also, you can find upcoming programs at www.commonwealthclub.org. So for our questions and answers, we've got the mic here, as I told you. And because the program is recorded, again, I ask you to please use the mic. So tonight, our program is Blueprint for a Creative Culture. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Kate Rutter before we start and bring Kate up here. Kate Rutter is an experienced designer at Adaptive Path. Adaptive Path is a design consultancy that works with companies to create products and services that deliver great experiences for their customers. Kate's professional life has been spent in digital media and the web, from development and design to product and service strategy. During her 10-plus years in the web industry, Kate has honed her talent for bringing companies and customers closer together through smart strategies and inventive design. She actively embraces the term specialized generalist. Kate's diverse and intense interests are constantly taking her and her clients to new places. Her background spans technology, marketing, interactive media, and business management. She's worked with corporations, startups, and nonprofit organizations to help them grow, change, and successfully chart new paths in ambiguous times and shifting markets. She's insanely curious about how organizations can support creative problem solving, positive human engagement, and cultures that embrace innovative and open thinking. Let's welcome Kate Rutter.
Thanks, Kevin and audience. It is such a pleasure to be here. It's a real honor. As Kevin mentioned, I am a designer by trade and by practice. And the kinds of things I design are the kinds of products that many of us use every day, applications for mobile phones, web applications, things on our computer, things that are prone to annoyance and frustration and inhumanity in the way that they just never understand what we need. So our company, Adaptive Path, is kind of in a position to try and untangle some of that complexity and provide real human interfaces for those products. So over the past few years, I've been exploring not only the methods that we use in doing this kind of digital design work, but also some of the themes that have emerged around how people work together when you have to do this kind of complex and more human, empathetic, and centered design. And so something that's really come up as a theme is this idea of creativity in corporate cultures and organization cultures. Adaptive Path has a very design-centric culture, so our bread and butter is new ideas and coming up with different ways of thinking about things. So we have some practices that we constantly need to reinforce to kind of keep ourselves from being complacent, as we're often designing for the edge of what might come into our homes in the next year, 5 years even. One of the things that I think makes it important in the design industry and field right now, and that's really becoming much more broadly known and a message that's really spreading out there, is this idea of a human-centered culture as organizations grow. So you've probably heard about places like Zappos, where it's very entrepreneurial, where it's very kind of wild and crazy in many regards. There's not this sense of watchfulness or this sense that by showing up and punching a time card, that's your participation model. Those models are really shifting. And that's what I found so intriguing, and I'd like to share some of the body of work that I've been developing on this topic with you tonight. So I want to start with a story, and the story starts here. Does this look familiar to anyone? Has anyone actually ever walked into a room like this? Yes. So I have a friend, very close friend, who is a kind of a magical thinker. She's intensely creative. She does a lot of community work and social work, and she was making a career change. And so she recently was in a new role, and I called her about a week after she started and said, "How's the new job going?" She said, "I have the most bizarre story to tell you." And I said, "Tell me more." She said, "Well, you know where I'm working." I said, "Yes." Actually, for background, she's working at a massive organization, so large I would call it institutional, and she was really interested in working in the procurement department. And her job is in the procurement department being a compliance officer for ensuring that all the numbers are correct and that everything is equitable in all of the paperwork before anybody gets paid. And that is a real creative light for her. So she was on about her third day, and she ended up in a room like this. She was in the break room, and she saw a new face. They're all new faces to her. But she'd seen him around for a while, and she said, hi. And he said, oh, you're new. And she said, yes, I am. And he said, so have you been lobotomized yet? And she was stunned, didn't quite know that she'd heard it correctly. And so he said it again, have you been lobotomized yet? And she said, I don't know what that means. And he said, well, you know, you're new. And you don't know what's going, but really it's like here. So you come in and everything's new and fresh and exciting. And then as you start learning it, you start seeing things that could change, things that could be improved, or things that frustrate you. And then you start thinking, oh, we could do something different. And you start to talk to people about that. But after a while, when nothing's changed and nothing looks like it's going to change, that's when the rage begins. You start to rattle at the jail cages and start feeling internally like, how can I escape from this? And he said then, one day, you wake up in the morning, you come into the office, and you just do your job. And that's when you know. He said, have a great day, and walked out of the break room. And you have to think, are you crazy? Is that what it takes? Just kind of a spirit being broken before you can actually engage? It was her first week. Was it a warning? Was it a cry for help? Who knows? But even in that story, and because it picked up on so many of the themes that I hear with clients, we're trying to change, but we can't. We have great ideas, but they don't go anywhere. They're too wrong. They put things on us. We can't get leadership to understand. All of these things are part of the consulting business and part of why a lot of times companies come to us to try and help them unravel these relationships so that they can get their work out in the world. But hearing that story really catalyzed it for me, and so I actually wrote down a belief statement, and I want to share it with you today because this is a conviction that I am committed to. I believe that every single one of us, every individual, has the right and the responsibility to do work that is interesting and meaningful and fun. And I also believe that every organization, whether that's a for-profit, a government institution, a nonprofit, or even community service-based organizations where there's not a pay or a bottom line that's financial, every organization and group of people has a responsibility to create a space where people can do that best work, openly and effectively. And here's the kicker, though. Companies are made of people, and we are those people. And when we think about companies as a great faceless divide that's not built of human beings, then we undercut our ability to actually feel like we can make any change. And I think ultimately, that's where the lobotomy comes in, and that's what's damaging to the human spirit. So after calming down and rattling my cage a little bit and think a little bit more authentically about this, I look back at some of the patterns I've seen with clients and that my colleagues have seen with clients, and honestly, patterns we have internally at our own organization, and I tried to retrace the steps. What would put someone into the space where the first thing they say to a new employee is, have you been lobotomized? What kind of context or progression or journey creates that? Now, it's all hypothetical, but knowing from other types of design processes, there are some things that do happen as something goes from idea to implementation to execution. And that is, you start out the world with possibilities, right? Say, for example, planning a trip. Where am I going to go? What could I do? What will that be like? What will I be wearing? Who will I talk to? Who will I meet? It's a world of possibilities. They're very open. I like to think about possibilities as a field of butterflies. They're beautiful and fleeting and hard to catch, but oh, so magical, right? Anything is possible. And possibilities, when those butterflies start to settle and become a little closer to the ground, they become opportunities. Things you can actually maybe get your arms around. We are going on that trip. We can budget for it. We can make a new design initiative in our organization. We can change up and restructure if we need to. Those become more discrete. They have harder edges, and they're understandable and a little bit more tangible for people to understand. And as that goes on, opportunities, when they actually become real in the world, become our responsibilities. So you design, you look at all the possibilities for a digital product. You make good choices based on the purpose and the resources that you have. You actually build those into a product that can go forward in the world, and then you need to care for it. This is when you need to show up, when you have those responsibilities. And we could talk about this also as ideation. We could talk about it as strategy. We could talk about it as launch. But I think there's another piece to the equation that we don't really think about, and that's what happens when our responsibilities lead to dependencies. And what's awesome about dependencies is they're so intimate, right? You depend on me, I depend on you. I mean, there's a really, that's where the bonding comes. That's where the human connection is most close. But that said, that also means if you change, maybe I'm not going to care, I'm not going to want that. Now I've become kind of a constraint for you because I have expectations. And by you changing, or by a situation changing, my expectations are disruptive. So in a past work experience, we changed an interaction on a website and revenue dropped. That was a dependency. We didn't know about it. We did afterwards, but we couldn't have seen it coming. And those are very real implications when you start screwing with the dependency system. I have a friend that says, don't mess the coping system. Don't mess with the coping mechanism. And a lot of coping mechanisms end up here. So I suspect that my sister's colleague or my friend's colleague ended up somewhere in some spiral after this and took a path where there were two options. One was total annihilation. You're so constrained by the work environment, you can't express any of your basic interesting way of thinking about it, so you're just going to blow up. Or you pick a lobotomy. So clearly in the case, he made a good choice, right? It's a better alternative. But that's not a better alternative for any of us. And that would be a funny story, and I'm sure it would be fine. It's only about 2 weeks old, so it's pretty new and very current, but it's not an isolated incident, right? The idea of jail and work is the same thing, is all over the place. There's this funny humor, you know, jail versus work. There's cartoons like this about the watercolor, or water cooler. Okay, listen up, everybody. Robinson has a plan for breaking out of here that I think might just work. They're standing there. Why aren't they, you know, what is it that creates such a situation that people need to fire against it? I think I'd have an easier time thinking outside the box if I didn't have to spend the whole day in a cubicle. And then, of course, the patron saint of dead, inhumane work environments. We've got Dilbert. So we know this is a theme and a trend. It's more than that. I think it's a cultural pattern we buy into. But I think it's dangerous. So what could we do if we looked at this continuum and said, what's missing? How can we actually use this so that it doesn't feel like a dead industry to lobotomy land? And the great thing about models is once you put something out there, you can start to play with the possibilities. And I started being really interested in the possibility space and the dependency space and wondering what could happen if instead of being a continuum, we turned this around to a cycle. How do we look for possibilities that have become opportunities and gone to responsibilities and swung around to dependencies? What happens here? How do we look at what we currently are dependent on as a way to ignite interesting and new possibilities? Mostly, how do we avoid this? So that was the context about the creative culture work. And even though it's not specific to design, I do think that design organizations and any creative organizations can't really thrive with that kind of underlying foundation. What's weird is, meanwhile, back at the ranch, I was actually doing a project specifically related to understanding and being more thoughtful and articulate about what kinds of tools and activities do companies, cultures need to invoke, inspire, and reinforce their current creative practice. And that's when this book came in. I've been reading, you know, there's a lot of books about the creative practice. It's certainly not a new message. And there's a ton of tools. There's some interesting things. It's just hard to kind of inculcate them and have them stick. And often they're too complicated for their own good. But this book on Harvard, on breakthrough thinking from the Harvard Business Review was interesting because it had an article by Dr. Teresa Amabile, who's dedicated her professional work to doing original research in corporate cultures. And she wrote an article called How to Kill Creativity, which I kind of loved because there's a lobotomy like just waiting right there. And when I read through this article, what I found was that there were a lot of touch points, but she was able to describe it in a way that was not only interesting and I could relate to that and see, I've seen that pattern play out in our clients, I've seen that pattern play out in organizations I've worked with, but also describe it in a way that seemed to kind of say, this is a complete worldview. But it was very hard to diagnose or get into that material in the written form. And so one of the things that that as part of my individual personal creative practice is I like to make maps of information. You saw how I made that model. I'm all about the models and the maps and kind of taking worlds and examples and trying to make them somehow visually related and find out what new relationships that can foster. And so as I was reading through this article, after a few series of kind of lists and mental mind maps, I actually created this thing that seemed to give it a landscape and about a basis that then I could use as information to validate some of the creative practices that I was seeing in the marketplace. And what's terrific about looking at it through this lens is that it really does crystallize three important parts about creative culture, which is a really big and open and amorphous topic. It can help us be a guide, not only in our own creative work, but also in a creative practice with others. And that's because there's only three simple steps: what creates a good culture, what feeds it, and what supports it. It's much more an organism than a machine. You all have copies of the Creative Blueprint on your Culture Blueprint on your chairs. It's teeny tiny print, and I get that. And it's probably going to be a little teeny tiny on the screen as well. But I do want to walk through some areas, because there's one thing that's different that I found in the use, and others have told me about the use of this map, that is different from some other more broader abstracted ways of looking at this, and that is the descriptions at they're broad, but then they actually are described in a way that you can start to see, oh, we do that in our company. We have this kind of system going, or we do this thing that seems to apply to that area of the map. And so I do want to walk through it, because I think this is going to help us answer the question of how we get from the dependency space to the possibility space. As a basic orientation, what creates it, what feeds it, and what supports it are these three different overarching kind of like rainbow things. And then underneath that is a section of kind of principles for general areas of creative participation. And they all go underneath the what creates it, what feeds it, and what supports it. Things like expertise and creative thinking skills and motivation. So certainly having expertise in one area will allow you to better devolve or better diagnose and kind of express the creative problem solving in that specific area. But what's interesting about the creative thinking skills, you add those in, that it's much more about a diversity of thinking and a diversity of different perspectives and how different people learn from each other instead of what you bring to the table. And then the third one about motivation is much more about what's in your heart. And I'll go through these in a little bit more detail. The second realm of what feeds it, being in an environment where there's challenge, where you feel freedom, where you're not just a clock watcher, where you have resources. You have space and time and money to be able to explore and appropriately solve problems, where there's that sense of play instead of work. And the last is around a leadership responsibility. As people take on more responsibility, they do develop dependencies within their teams and within those teams in fighting or trying to be able to obtain the kinds of resources and support systems that a good creative culture needs. So work group features, how do people work together? Is it okay to just be passive? What's the level of engagement? What's the level of honesty? Under supervisory encouragement, is it okay to rock the boat? Are you invited to rock the boat? Or is it all just about same old, same old? And leadership support, is it part of the organizational charter to move forward and do different things? Actually, there are times I was in an organization that wasn't moving forward for too long, sadly, and the business and the service was provided was pretty exemplary, but unfortunately, you know, just because the business didn't move, the world did. So you don't have to be the first mover, but you do have to kind of keep up. You got to evolve. Any organism that's not growing or changing is not growing and changing. It's probably dying. So there is the charter from leadership that you have to stay current, that you need to be at least in relationship to the customers or the constituents you serve is really fundamental. So looking at these into a little bit more detail, I want to tell a couple stories and show you a few tools that we've developed through Adaptive Path and our client work that have really brought these home in fairly simple and accessible ways. then we're not going to walk through every element of the creative blueprint in detail. I leave that for you to explore on your own or for another time, but I do want to cover some of the highlights. The idea of expertise that's acquired from formal education has had such a sense of pedigree in the past, but increasingly we're finding that professional experience and interaction with colleagues and peers is really trumping that card. So exploring individual projects or working on a collaborative type of initiative outside of work, but in more of a peer or a collegial situation, is becoming a really important way of continuously kind of re-advancing and reinvesting in your own thoughts. Under creative thinking skills, the ability to look across multiple intellectual spaces for ideas. One of the design practices that we use quite often is coming in with prompts that really have nothing to do with a digital service. Once you're too far within that one little area of exploration, you actually can't get enough breathing room to try and be able to think about different inspiration. So we use a lot of tools like metaphor. We'll bring in pictures and mood boards and color boards and say, if this product were to be a leaf or a lens, some of them are silly, but all of them are evocative. Even asking those simple questions help us break out of our everyday expectations. And once you break that expectation, your brain necessarily has to force a picture of what that unusual combination would look like. It's amazing what kinds of ideas result from that. The ability to depart from the status quo and the ability to let others depart from the status quo, even if you don't like it. It's much more about people relationships rather than individual thinking and how smart or how creative or how good at any one thing you are, but just the ability to do something different and to feel good about it. And then the motivation that comes from within rather than a carrot and a stick. Motivation that's not about punishment, instead it's about honest curiosity. And the most insightful book that I've read on this topic is Drive by Daniel Pink. It's fairly new. It came out last year. He talks about how motivation in organizations has been shifting from this motivation 1.0, as he calls it, which is about this reward system, which at its fundamental nature assumes that you are going to hate your work and that you need to be paid to be there at all. Now, if I'm like most people, I like to make a healthy living. That said, sometimes I have actually said things like, there's not enough money in the world that you could pay me to do that. Who else has ever said anything like that? Great. I'll never be an event planner. That's just all there is to it. But this idea that if you don't have mastery or autonomy or purpose, that there's no internal drive, you actually aren't going to be able to fulfill and to function in kind of your broadest, most effective human way. And then when we wonder why people don't seem human at work, if we're not activating those things that make us human, it seems like that's an obvious answer why. So here's a simple thing that has been extraordinarily effective, not only through clients that I've worked with that have design teams or research teams, it's also very common, but also through adaptive paths practice, is just the simple idea of a brown bag. And I'm going to describe a little bit about what that looks like. They don't take a lot of time and effort, but they're incredibly interesting just to keep that kind of creative mental muscle toned and working. So in brown bags, a team gathers to get exposed to different ideas and discusses topics related to our work. So we set aside time on Tuesdays from 12 to 1 once a week to do it. Sometimes if there's a lot going on, we'll have more than one. Sometimes we'll miss a few weeks. But there's an expectation within the culture that there will be something interesting happening at that time. There's no one coordinator. Anyone can host it. Anyone can pull it together. Email goes out to everyone. We're a company of about 40. About 30 are in the San Francisco studio. And we often invite in special guests. Who's doing something interesting in augmented reality? Where's the next interaction paradigm coming from? Who's doing something really bizarre with data visualization? This doesn't directly touch most of our work right now, but it will. And we want to be hearing and talking with the people that are out there exploring those vanguards so that we'll have a better appreciation and understanding of it. If we can't pull someone in person, we can also just watch a TED Talk. 20 minutes, they're easy. You can actually eat lunch and still have a participatory experience, and then having a discussion afterwards. Internal brown bags also give us a conduit to get to know each other a little bit better. So as new people come, we can have staff portfolio reviews or a focused discussion around a hot topic in the organization. And in a way, it's almost like Disney. In a way, these provide this moment of bonding across the organization that when things get hard and we're frustrated and we're angry with each other and we don't want to be our best self, we have that foundation of respect and care and appreciation for each other. And you don't build that when you're pissed off. So looking back at why we thought that, why I thought brown bags were so important, I actually did a comparison against the areas that that would activate in this creative blueprint. And it does pretty well. Areas of hearing about other adjacent intellectual spaces, getting to know your staff members and your teammates better, being able to have a variety of conversations, having dedicated time and space for that. It actually does pull up things that are reinforced with the research on creativity. The second chunk of let's feed it. So you've got this entity, this creative culture. Then how do you maintain it? How do you reinforce it? And what's fascinating about this area of exploration is that people come to expect. It's kind of like when your body is heavy. When you have more lean muscle, you actually burn fat better. Who knew, right? This is the lean muscle part of your cultural organization. And it's about challenge and freedom and resources. Having people match their good stuff and their curiosity and their intrinsic motivation with things that would reinforce that. Knowing people, their interests, their skills, their expertise, their styles. Freedom, I think, is a really hard topic, especially in organizations that are quite large where structure and communication is so regimented, trying to clean up the system. But, you know, humans are messy and communication is messy. So there's only so much of that you can do without really just shutting down the communication. So it's still messy. There's just less of it. But the ability to define how something happens can give someone autonomy and ownership that's directly associated with their ability to actually perform that job. So, for example, a lot of a specific client work that we did was the product challenge was to create a new suite of services that was outside kind of the web application that they currently did. They wanted to serve their banking audience with a new set of services. But instead of saying, we want to have to raise our consumer logins or engagement this degree, and we want to serve with this purpose in mind, it was very much, we need you to build an application so that people can log in and check their balances and also get marketed to around this specific new product. It was very much about how you do it. And that really robbed the team from being able to come up with any innovative or interesting ideas, because essentially at that point they felt like order takers. And once that dynamic started, it was very, very difficult to try and untangle it. So think as high as you can. What is the actual purpose we're trying to accomplish? And let the people that are really interested and curious figure out how. And be okay when they surprise you. In order to do that, you really need to have goals that aren't going to shift either. So once you have a shifting, waffly goal, it gets very difficult because you've aligned that purpose and now that purpose is changing. Honestly, I don't have an answer for that. If you do, see me afterwards, because I would love to hear your mojo on that. Goals that don't shift in the very, very fast-moving, kind of indecisive, especially, environments are really tricky. Under resources, some of them are simple, some of them are hard. Money, time, and space, and a good culture. Thinking about the culture as an actual entity, almost a pet, or as a world, an environment that you care for, is really important so that you actually can start to care for this thing almost as if it's part of our planet, right? You have to care for the space in between people as much as you care for them. And then lastly, I wanted to introduce what we call at Adaptive Path our open design sessions. You can call them anything, open problem-solving sessions, open input sessions, but these are one-hour sessions, again, set aside in advance, where any project team working on a challenge opens up participation way beyond their own project microcosm. And during the hour, the team has access to new ideas, fresh eyes, fresh perspectives. Not only is that terrific in the hour, but it has the ability to kind of reset the team that's been really digging in and working on this. It's kind of absorbed and immersed, really help that step back and take an outside perspective. Not only that, but because you're putting your design work out there, it's very difficult to become shirty when people are giving you critique. By asking for critique in a proactive manner, it really helps you take feedback and understand that everybody's purpose or everybody's participation is about making those products or that decision better. It's not about whether or not your designs are kind of bad. and getting exposure to how people work, how they articulate their thoughts, what they agree with, what they don't agree with, again, is part of that knowledge where we need to know each other better. And having those rational and authentic conversations on areas where you disagree is extraordinarily important. Looking at the open design sessions, there's a little thumbnail up at the top. They actually activate a whole bunch of the various enzymes of the various different areas of a creative culture. And now we know why. We can do away with open design sessions anytime we like. But we would be robbing ourselves if we didn't find something to replace the input and the power that those sessions actually give us. So throw out the bathwater, keep the baby. The last thing that supports it can be a little dicey. These are specifically things that are often within the realm of managers and less maybe into the individual contributors, which I have been most of my life. Work group features and supervisory encouragement, the rah-rah system from leadership. But that sense of mutual support and diverse perspectives is something that work group features really can support. It needs to be okay to have a very different set of skills, even if that means we might not get along at first. It's more than offset by this idea of the willingness to help, kind of take one for the team, and the shared excitement around what you're creating together. For supervisory encouragement, the big hotspots that I see come up over and over again is this guard against a culture of fear, this ability to say it's okay to have conversations. We won't necessarily do the things that scare us, but we have to be able to talk about them. It's kind of like if you've ever purchased insurance and you kind of have to think about all the horrible things that could happen to you so that you can know how much you need to pay so that if they do happen to you, you actually aren't like totally, your family is protected and safe. It's kind of terrible, right? But it's also kind of important because you realize you have a more realistic everyday relationship to what could happen, and then it feels so much safer when you know that you're going to be covered. Banishing negative bias. This is a great one, too. most of the design sessions that we begin start with, again, this possibility space where you're doing things like brainstorming or structured ideation, as we call it. If that's a fancy name for saying we write ideas down on sticky notes, we stick them up on a really big wall, and then we put them into little clusters, and then we name the clusters, and then we draw pictures of what we think that cluster could look like. But this idea of, oh, that's a dumb idea, you know, just one off like that can really shut someone down. This negative bias that change isn't okay, or oh, that's stupid. Even these, it's just, what about that idea could be true? What about that concept would be interesting? These opening questions can really shift how people think about that. And for this, we have this, I call this like the 12-minute warm-up or the calisthenics, perhaps, of a creative culture. there's a concept called five-minute madness. In five-minute madness, at Adaptive Path, we do it monthly. We have an all-hands meeting once a month, but you can do it in any shape and size as long as there's, you know, a few people in the room. It's a five-minute session where someone makes a statement that they don't know is true or that they think might not be true. And then the group discusses it for 5 minutes, and that time is enforced. And we actually have a stop sign we hold up. And that's the whole process of doing this helps you say things that you're not sure about. Of course you're going to be wrong, because that's the whole point, is to kind of be wrong, but to put it out there so that you can get righter together. It keeps us uncomfortable. It keeps us feeling like we're not quite sure how confident we need to be in our ideas. It keeps us open to being wrong in service of the sharing of ideas. And that, in turn, keeps our creative thinking skills honed because it encourages departing from that status quo. And it reinforces the importance of the diverse perspectives in our work groups. So when you look at the creative culture, a lot of the areas of the five-minute madness usually happen of what a leadership team or supervisory oversight would need to provide. But you can do this, and when it becomes okay to practice that way, people will model each other's behavior. And they'll actually all start to feel okay saying things that we don't think are true. It sounds so simple, but it's really hard. There have been even topics where I've been like, I don't want to do that in five-minute madness. I'm just not sure. You know, what the heck? That's what it's there for. And the last chunk of leadership support, I think, is often very difficult to feel like you can do on your own. This idea of mandating information sharing. So you have to share what you know. These are more didactic or more directives But they are important so that everybody has this kind of equal shared playing field of idea of concept sharing and creative communication. Making sure the political problems don't fester. Encourage sharing outside the organization. Not just having an internal culture that is open and participatory, but actually putting that work out there and maybe knowing it's not quite right. And on this one, because this is such like the patron saint of the leadership support, I really like a topic that came up with a former colleague that that she tried in her organization, which is this guerrilla collaboration. So she worked in an organization, also large, also institutional, conventional, very conservative. And she was working on a design problem. She was what we call a UX team of one, which is she was totally responsible for the user experience of all the web products that they sent out. But she didn't have enough information or enough buy-in or feedback to be able to feel like she could do that with confidence. And so what she did is she just started doing her work out loud. And she would write her the concepts and the ideas that she was coming with, and she stuck them to the outside of her door. Sometimes she'd have a note like, hey, what do you guys think? But sometimes it would just be out there. And it was ugly, and it was not attractive or clean, as the aesthetic of the office was. And people were a little concerned about what was going on, but they all lived in offices, so it didn't really affect people that much. But as people walked by, they slowly started to stop, and then she'd have sticky notes and a pen, like, write what you think. And slowly this wall became this walk-by place where it was collaborative, but it wasn't at the same time, but people were able to feel like they could participate in her work. And she was telling me the story, and she said, you know, the weirdest thing is now when we have meetings, we actually kind of talk about different things. And she recognizes that that started happening when she started to work out loud, as she called it. And so after hearing her story, I went through, and I looked at all those things on the blueprint that it touched on, and she's like, seriously, she's like the perfect energy drink of actually activating a creative culture with that one act, that one persistent, I'm going to work out loud act. She created this intellectual space for people to participate. She was motivated by and was able to express her passion and interest for her work, which was very isolated. She was the only specialist of that skill set in the organization. She made space. It was the back of her door, the front of her door. She was able to get diverse perspectives from other people outside of her own realm of thinking. She definitely departed from the status quo. And in the leadership support area, she mandated her own information sharing. And she found that other people were starting to model that behavior as well. So as you continue, you can use this idea or this model or some of the concepts that are baked into this visualization as a way to assess what do we do well in our organization? What could our group benefit from? Are there big areas we're missing? What would an idea or what would a tool or a task or an activity look like that could fit and maybe help us move things around a little bit? So because most of the work I do is participatory and actually active, I am going to ask you to do the same. Have two different models now, two different things to pull from. This model of opening up possibilities from dependencies and a creative culture model, but you also have probably ideas and thoughts in your own head, and you have this. You have an index card that was also on your seat, and I hope you have a pen because I did not bring any with me today. And I'm going to ask you to do a little bit of work. I know. Negative bias. I can smell it from here. That's right. But bear with me. So once you've got your card out, I want you to write down two things. What is one thing that you do today that you want to stop doing, but that others depend on you for? Be nice if it's a work environment, but it doesn't have to be. Just something that you would really, your life would be better if you could just stop doing it. Just one thing. Doesn't have to be complicated. And then after that, I want you to write one thing that you're passionate about. Something that gets you up in the morning. Something that when you think about it, you take a little breath and you kind of your eyes light up. Just one thing. We're just going to take a little minute for that. And when you're done, go ahead and look up so that I can kind of rate the room.
going to take this moment to remind our audience listening at home that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Blueprint for a Creative Culture with Kate Rutter. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight.
Terrific. Thanks, Kevin. So we're going to put on the Wayback Machine for a little while. This is one of my favorite quotes. A wonderful harmony is created when we join together the seemingly unconnected. So you know where this is going, right? Like this, you're smart folk. So you have one more minute, and there's a third task, which is what is one idea that could satisfy, how you can satisfy both of those disparate things. One way, one thing, one activity, something you could do in the world. They could bring those together, hopefully to solve the thing you don't want to do anymore, but that's leading. And it doesn't have to be fully realized. You can just make a few notes. And lastly, I got permission from Kevin ahead of time to do this. When you're done with that, I'm going to ask you to go outside of your comfort zone, and I want you to share that great idea with the person sitting next to you. And on this, we've got 3 minutes, and then I'm going to have to put up a stop sign because I know how rudely y'all are going to get. Okay? And if you know that person, see if there's someone on the other side that you don't know. Yeah, we're coming in.
So we'll just do questions and answers. So I asked a question that you would like to ask to the first time.
So I think 2 minutes on this, because we're already 6:51.
We're okay. I mean, if we're not.
Is that only 20 minutes? Or no, it started at 6. Okay. Oh, yeah, it's longer than I thought.
We started about 5 minutes.
Okay.
about that. It's 5 minutes, huh?
Maybe about 5 minutes.
Because it's worth all of this. The 1 hour is for the radio program. So don't worry about it.
Okay.
You have freedom to go to do what you want.
Okay, good.
It's one of my favorite.
Oh. Okay, we're going to wrap it up in about 30 seconds here, so make sure that you both had a chance to talk. Okay. Now I'm going to ask if there's a brave soul who wants to share theirs with the whole group and with all of the radio listeners at home. Is there someone who's interested in doing that? Come on. Just one volunteer. Excellent. Okay, we have a volunteer. So, the dependency is cleaning the shared public spaces, something to get rid of. And the passion is brainstorming. So the combination and the idea out of that is come up with a creative and alternative ways to get support to keep the public space clean through brainstorming, I'm assuming, which is a really lovely thing. And because creative participation is always promptly rewarded, I want to thank you. So looking back at what we've covered together this evening, you've got a toolkit. You have this model for awareness so that you can know when it's time to envision those new possibilities before you start rattling that cage and feeling frustrated with it without necessarily having a place to put that energy in a directive way. You have a blueprint for how you can create, feed, and support a creative culture, enhance it, assess it, kind of tone it up, or shift it around. And lastly, you have a personal starting point that you can start to put into practice. And if you really want to go beyond just the individual contributors and start to see what this can do within your organizations and your work groups, here's a few challenges for you. In the next week or so, talk to 2 new people about your work. But ask them what they do that's similar or very different and actively listen for and write down possibilities that inspires. Host a brown bag or a collaborative problem-solving session. Bring new ideas into your environment. And pilot a 5-minute madness. Just once. See how it goes. It could be a train wreck. We all learn from mistakes. But it could be really, really interesting. It just might be the outlet that people are really yearning for. And when we start doing these and we model the behaviors and they are effective and they start being used as ways to come up with interesting and appropriate products, services, whatever the purpose of our organization is, I think we'll see a new future vision. I think we'll see companies that are made of people who are open and inspired and who support each other in envisioning and building positive futures. And so we can claim our own power and we can use it. And I think we could see every company as a place where we can do our best work openly and effectively. And that would build a future where each and every one of us can use our creative mojo in work that's interesting and fun and meaningful. And now I want to go back to scene 2, which is a revised break room. They've had a perk up. But how could that story have gone differently? And best of all, no lobotomies. So thank you very much for your time. I'd like to give shout-outs to the contributors, Dr. Teresa Amabile and Leah Bewley, and some of the colleagues who also did a couple of the sketches. And a big thanks to you for participating. It's always scary to ask people to do that, and I know you didn't come with that expectation, so I really am thankful and appreciative of that. And thank you very much for sharing your evening with me.
You were kind enough to mention that one book, Daniel Pink, who in another life was a speechwriter for Vice President of the United States. Do you have any more books or things that have come out that you would recommend, sort of an ad hoc reading list, if you will?
Sure. And I have it verbally. I won't be able to get you all of the authors, but there's Weird Ideas That Work, which is very good and funny. And actually touches, inspired some of the adaptations to the Creative Blueprint, and touches on many of the same topics. There's, from more of a practice perspective, there's Visual Meetings, which is by David Sibet. He's with the Grove Consultants, and they have pioneered a whole graphical way of doing facilitation and communication within organizations. It's extraordinary and compelling and transformative, and that's called Visual Meetings, I believe. It's fairly new. There's also GameStorming. If you're looking for activities and different types of tools to use, GameStorming is a book by Suni Brown and Dave Gray and Mancuso, a third author. And it has a whole bunch of different very participatory activities that really can open people up and kind of get groups working in very different ways. And then the last, if you're looking at problem solving and you want to take more of a visual approach to it, there's The Back of the Napkin by Dan Rome, which is a very structured entry into something that I think is often relegated to the realms of the creatives, which is making marks on paper with mark-making things. Some would call it drawing or sketching, but I think it is neither. I think it is mark-making, and we're natural mark-makers. So that's a terrific book. Lastly, if you're a sticky note and 3M fan such as I am, there is Rapid Problem Solving with Sticky Notes or Post-its, trademark, by David Straker. It's older, brilliant, and very, very effective. So I hope that's enough to start. Back of the napkin. Yeah. Anything else?
So you mentioned authentic a few times in your presentation. So I just wanted to know a little bit more about how you define authentic communication.
Sure. That's a great question. And I think I'm so concerned that authentic will be the new synergy. You know, that when you actually start having to come up with a press release campaign around what's authentic, that maybe we're not having the right conversation. So I started looking at candid as kind of as an alternative. But I think there's something when I see conversations about authentic design or authentic conversation and collaboration, it's much more on, well, first of all, a little bit of a caveat. I think people can tell when you're lying. And I think people can tell when you don't give a shit. And so to me, I think perhaps authenticism is much less about what the person thinks they're saying and much more about what we believe we're hearing. So being an authentic communicator, I don't think that's up to you. You might be completely convinced, but if it smells a little wrong, I think people can pick that up. So I'd like to see a counterpart to authentic communication, which is about being able to call someone out or really probe on what you think is not quite right with when you're hearing a message or you're not hearing it. And there have been situations where people misspeak. I mean, we had a situation in our organization recently that was fairly volatile, where a truth was made, but it was not a truth. It was a truth at the moment, but, you know, the truth has changed, as someone once told me. And so looking back, it felt like that was not a consistent picture. And it felt very difficult for that person to be perceived as an authentic speaker when it wasn't a consistent message. So, but it was authentic at the time. So I look forward to a lot more exploration to it, but I don't necessarily want authentic to become a flag under which everything is permissible now because we've got a better name for it. Yes?
I was in the library today reading a book that was all for universities coming together, and it was another David Brooks, and he's working on his PhD. But he was talking about in the classroom to engage people that maybe somebody might just say something that is questionable, is it really true or not? And then raising the question about that, well, is this really for sure? And arousing the curiosity and taking it further to really have an exciting class talk. And what I thought was exciting was to take those skills and that you can apply it in a community, because I'm dealing with, you know, how do we get rid of our lawns with communities that want to just keep them, you know, because they want the golf course thing look. And also I'm in the classroom as a substitute teacher, so I get challenged every time I'm there. And that authentic question that came up, that after 5 years, I love it that I get the compliment that I do care and they know that I tell the truth, whatever it is for me. And I love how you added on, too. Sometimes the truth does change.
But add on, the one who was speaking yesterday, and he's over at Herb Skaters coming up, or did, David Brooks with the New York Times, we're dealing with so many people that don't have this opportunity to talk with one another. They want to text, they want to do everything, and we're having split seconds delayed reaction, and people are strolling down, and they don't know how to talk with one another.
You know, I think that's a really good point about that, that talking and the listening. And you mentioned an important word to that, and that's challenge. And there's, there's, I haven't put a lot of direct thinking into this, but it's become very clear that there are specific types of what I call like unfanged words, that when you come up with a challenge, having a challenge towards curiosity rather than belligerence is really important. So I started, this is all new and I haven't really given a lot of thought, so forgive me if it's a little wonky, but the idea that every question has kind of a posture to it, and it can be a posture that's fairly aggressive, or it can be a posture that's fairly inviting. And our conversation, I think, and our mannerisms actually do that. So what I'd be interested in is how, if anybody has read any work around kind of conversational posture, or how you relate kind of in a questioning way, so that it doesn't become this challenge or belligerence, because I think that's when defensiveness starts. And once you get people that are defensive, they're just going to shut down. So, and talking about the truth has changed. Well, whose truth is it? There was a quote, and it's really lovely. It says, there's two kinds of truths. There's a big truth and a small truth. And you'll know the small truth because its opposite is a falsehood. And you'll know the great truth because its opposite is another great truth. And that really kind of made me pause for quite a while. There's a lot of very great truths out there. Yes.
What is the best way to deal with someone who calls and gives you all this information that you know is not correct, that is not the latest? What is the best way to deal with that person, to approach them?
That's a good question. It certainly depends on the situation. I think ask. I would love to know more about how you know that. Essentially, it's asking for sources. But think about it as, who do you know, what do you know, and how do you know it? And there's a lot of assumptions. I think assumptions are kind of the shortcuts to daily life. We have to make a lot of assumptions to get through. And if someone has jumped to conclusions and you have a disagreement, then it's important, I think, to probe and find out, how did you come to that understanding? There's some really wonderful phrases. How did you come to that understanding? Or where could I go to learn the same information that you are sharing with me now? So that kind of helps you better understand the basis for the thought. But once it goes in the head, you know, assumptions and conclusions can come up. But at least you can have a conversation about it. And if it's like, oh, I read it on the interweb, well, you know, all bets are off as if it's accurate or not. But I would actually just ask a question back. Yeah, and when, right. How did you know that, and when? Right.
Do you think that everybody's creative, like people that might seem non-creative, like it just needs to be brought out, or do you think that there really are people who just aren't very creative? And, like, I guess what's your perspective on that in a creative organization?
Yeah, that's always tricky. So I wouldn't starve if I lived alone, but I'm no cook, right? So I can feed myself. I have the basic mechanics of being able to not kill myself by not being, you know, through starvation. But I'm really glad I live with someone that actually does know the mechanics of cooking and actually takes a creative expression in it. I think it is in the human nature to create things. We create a new day every single time we wake up. I don't think we can get around it. I think an acclimation or an excitement around change is different. I think it takes an extraordinary amount of creativity not to change, to actually fight the battle of, I mean, imagine like you're in a boat and the current's going and you're trying to stay there. That's a huge amount of effort, right? So I think that sometimes creativity lurks in unexpected places. And yes, I do believe everyone is creative. That doesn't mean I want everybody to be my creative partner. I want to be able to be a little bit more curatorial about that. And that certainly does not mean that I am everybody's creative partner. I know I'm an acquired taste. So. Anybody else? Well, thank you again for coming. This was such a pleasure.
Okay, well, thank you, Kate Rutter. Our program tonight has been A Blueprint for a Creative Culture. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. And I'd like to thank our audience listening at home. I'd like to thank our audience here at the club tonight. And with that, I'll close our program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened public discussion.